Except for it's a really good retail.
It's going to run better, too. I got to go, Mr. Chairman. I got another appointment. Sorry.
This is the slide that David was showing earlier with just a little more detail. What you can see here is that in 2017, we were manned, probably overmanned, for what the winter brought us. You can see that we met most of our targets pretty effectively. You can see our priority two roads were in pretty good shape within the time frame that we wanted to get our priority one roads in. What you see in 2018 is we had a much different winter, and we weren't able to meet any of our target priorities. So as we get more data, this will be really important to help us figure out if we're appropriately staffed for the types of winters we're seeing.
Maybe something to consider is when you, as time goes on and you have multiple years stacked, you have put some kind of weather index on it, or somehow to, for the, you know, the folks sitting here that have a 5 or 10 year, you know, multi-year view, that they kind of gear in that, you know, the weather has a significant factor in performance, and you don't control it.
Senator Stedman, we will take that into consideration and figure out how we could kind of manage that, if perhaps we could count number of severe weather events or icing events. I know that for Fairbanks and the extreme length of time it took to get back to get our priority one roads back to the bare pavement that we want to achieve, we were hammered by ice storm after ice storm. The next slide indicates what and how we're tracking metrics for providing transportation services, and this relates to the international airport system. The cargo input or throughput in Anchorage is a significant contributor to the to how that international airport operates, and the airport is a significant contributor to the economy of the Anchorage area. So you can see that in FY18, we were seeing a little bit of an increase again in the throughput of cargo, and then this is by month. Excuse me. You can see that by month.
So you're growing year on year, which is good. This is a positive. We should actually have, as we put this budget monster in the middle of the table, it's always nice to look around for good news, and we should be tooting the horn on the operations of the Anchorage Airport and the economic stimulus it brings into the community and the state. It's a third of Anchorage, and clearly it looks almost like an October year-on-year increase every year. So
this is a really nice slide, and our international airport system is really a gem, and we Deputy Commissioner Bender is here to accept all compliments.
Yeah, well, we're going to need some good news, because everything's going to be negative and end of the world news here.
And the airport is truly a great example of how to operate an airport. We're extremely lucky in our geographic location. We have worked very, very hard to maximize everything we've.
And then on the next slide, on slide 9, this is your merger proposal to merge the Marine Highway into the airports. Is that correct?
We would consider that. This slide is an attempt to just indicate how well we are at actually meeting the schedule that we're sailing. And you can see that there are boats in particular that we have had significant problems with, and we have not been able to sail the weeks of service that we intended to. And we all know that when a boat isn't in service when it should be, the whole system is impacted by that change. We would attribute, we can attribute much of this to the fact that our boats are old, and when they go into overhaul, we tend to find more than we anticipated, and they need additional attention. And every once in a while, an engine just stops working, and we sit for a few days while we have to get that repaired.
Right. Some of us have been concerned for many, many years that as these ships get older, now they're, what, 50 years old, some of them. You know, our maintenance dollars aren't keeping up with the age progression, and we're trying to get these new ships online, two of which are just about done, so we can retire some of this old iron and get it out of the water. So this is not, there's no surprise here. All right.
No, not our ships are really, really old. And frankly, a compliment to the Marine Highway System, they have done a bang-up job keeping them operating for as long as they have.
Mm-hmm.
Our final provide slide is the Whittier Tunnel and the number of vehicles that go through the Whittier Tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an explanation for you on why there were fewer vehicles going through in 2018 than there were the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be talking to our Whittier Tunnel folks to see if there was an incident or something that caused the tunnel to...
Is it a toll tunnel?
It is.
And it's, and don't they have a separate tunnel for the railroad?
No.
Same tunnel? They just blew it out bigger?
Yeah, and they close it for the way there's closures so that the trains can come through and then the cars.
It might be something. I know it's not, it's kind of off subject, but sometime when we get together, I need to get spun up on that, on the tunnel and the train and how much capacity they can get a train through that tunnel. And I know there's been interest in making sure we got the ability to get a lot of volume through that tunnel if need be.
Senator Stedman, this is our newest division, in quotes here. This is our shared service, our division of facility services. And this is a true shared service in that we are bringing together the maintenance responsibilities for various other departments' facilities. And as we bring other agencies on board, sometimes we bring all of them, sometimes we bring a subset of their buildings on board, we are negotiating with them for a specific shared service. So we are going to tell them what they get for the dollars that it will cost them. You can see that we set a target limit here of having our work orders responded to and a resolution of those work orders, which may not necessarily be the same thing, of having those resolved within 72 hours. And we're doing a great job right now in getting them resolved in about half that time. So we really look forward to increasing our facilities services. And as we increase, we believe we'll get more and more efficient if we aren't paving in the middle of winter. While the earthquake is not something to brag about, DOT did a great job in responding to the earthquake. I think it really demonstrates the ability of the department to mobilize, and it also is a example of the partnerships that we have developed with our contractors. The second slide here are the significant DOT damage sites that we have found. We have, there's quite a lot here, and we're finding more and anticipate to find more as summer comes along, as the
right.
Snow melts.
When, and in, we're going to be bogged down in this budget, clear to our throats for quite some time, but in that process, we're going to deal with a fast-track supplemental. And I would imagine the main target of that's going to be the earthquake response. And we'll be asking DOT to come forward with information like this, but within more detail of the damage to the system. And also to give you an opportunity to not only explain to the committee the damage and why you need the appropriation, but to take a little bit of time to talk about the response that DOT had and their crew, and even to support construction companies, because that's kind of a positive result of this incident. But we're going to definitely be asking DOT for more information on the damage than just the, you know, dollar appropriation language.
Senator Sedman, some of our folks are giving a presentation in Senate Transportation today on the earthquake. Mm-hmm. I'll just kind of skip through to the other slides. We have requested a 90-day extension and have been granted that from FHWA, so this will give us a significantly increased amount of time after breakup to be able to identify what's ongoing and what we've missed, and perhaps what has occurred through the aftershocks. Our facilities folks were out as well as our DOT folks, and they inspected all of the state-owned buildings, and we anticipate that there's going to be about $6 to $10 million worth of repairs there. The buildings that were most impacted were our headquarters building, the Bonnie Courthouse, and our DOT annex. And then I'm just going to scroll down here to our last picture. Last Friday, we held a thank you in conjunction with the Alaska General Contractors. And its purpose was to thank the contractors who really came out and made the response to the earthquake such an amazing success. And I wanted to include this picture. This is Dana Pruz's paving crew out there on a snowy day. And truly, these contractors worked with us hand in hand. They were ready to go before we had contracts signed, and it contributed to an incredible success. So we tried to thank them. We don't have a lot of ways of being able to thank our contractors, mm-hmm. so we had them all over for cookies and coffee.
No, that's nice. I know it's awkward as a, you know, as a public entity to do those type of thank yous, but one thing it'd be nice too when we talk about our different divisions is to require the South Coast region to perform as a quality of work as the other regions, so our asphalt is flat. And if the boys can't pave, they can practice a couple of times and get her. flat is good.
Flat is good, Senator.
Yeah. So I've just noticed a few things as you know, we as I travel around the district, the differences in the communities and the it's noticeable. Even though I think now in our region we have one paving outfit, one asphalt plant in Southeast pretty much. So that might rectify some of that, but hopefully at some point there'll be some price competition so we can get more asphalt miles done versus fewer, because competition's good in the system. But
competition is very good.
But make sure the next guy comes in, tell him he's got to keep up with the other regions so I don't get embarrassed when I go see Senator Bishop's region and his roads are flat.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we are very proud of our northern region, and they do have young folks who are really interested in taking advantage of all the latest in technology, and we are working to install that department-wide.
Yeah, I see that, and I see there's a contractor in Southeast now that has, and maybe there's more than one, that has the GPS mounting devices on a lot of their machinery and stuff, so we... you know, we're moving forward also, which is good. We've got to keep up with technology and to encourage our contractors to do that. I think the accuracy of the quantities and overruns with that type of equipment would be helpful, or is helpful. We're about out of time. Do we have any final comments before I let you off the hot seat?
No, Senator, thank you. And Commissioner McKinnon apologizes for not being here.
I know he's really sad, but he'll...
Very sad.
We'll bring him back when we have the budget, because we want all the commissioners here to help us with this joint effort of dealing with the budget. I think it's going to be beneficial to have OMB and the commissioners sitting at the end of the table with, and we've enlarged the finance committee to try to help deal with this across the state so we don't end up in one big log jam and we sit and watch the treasury burn.
Senator Stedman, we look forward to being able to have those conversations with you.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming today. We are adjourned. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order February 7th, 2019. If you could please just remind everybody to shut their mute button off on their telephone would be appreciated. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop. Excuse me, Senator Bishop will be here. Was here a minute ago. Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilikowski. We have one broad item today. We're going to have a fiscal impact discussion on the opioid crisis, which will be dealt with somewhat in some budget issues coming up. But we have some primary speakers from the Department of HES and Social Services, Public Safety, Law and Corrections. And I think what I'll do is I'll just have the presenters have already jumped at the table. We have a slide deck, unfortunately long. We have 2 hours. I'll kind of watch the clock. I've talked to them briefly on the time limit, so they're going to try to get through their stuff on time. They might have to skip pieces here and there to get it done in 2 hours. We will follow the general guidelines at the table of asking questions at the end of a slide, but if the members could please be a little cognizant also of the long presentation, surprisingly long today, and we'll do our best to get through it. And with that, I'd like the three folks at the end of the table to introduce themselves, who they represent, and then how they want to lay the information out to the committee, and we'll start off. Yes, just a second here. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I just want to say thank you very much for being here today. This was when Senator Stedman and I were talking about how Senate Finance Committee may conduct its business this year. One of the ideas that we came up with was, rather than having a particular single department present a program, what about taking big overarching issues and having multiple departments that may be handling that issue in a slightly different way present together? So this is, you're the very first prototype, guinea pig, if you will, and we've chosen the opioid issue because it's such an overarching problem in our state, as we can see with the crime bills and so forth. The reason why I suggested this is when it's close to home. Just last week, I am grieving for a family who lost their 42-year-old son. He's a father of three, and it was an accidental drug overdose, and they're planning his funeral now. So this is very real. I know that there's the McDowell Group. I mean, I have statistics here. I just wanted to kind of put on the record. The McDowell Group estimates that the economic impact of drug abuse costs the Alaska economy $1.2 billion a year. We've had a string of overdose deaths that have been climbing since 2013, even earlier than that. Direct spending in 2018 alone for opioid treatment was $70 million. Within that total, the Department of Health and Social Service opioid spending was $60 million, Public Safety $8 million, Corrections $5 million, Department of Law $2 million. So it's touching all sorts of departments. We believe that collaboration and cooperation is the best way to tackle big issues, sharing data, sharing best practices, communicating with one another, and that's one of the purposes of having several departments today. So I just thank you for being here, and I'll conclude my comments because I know we got a big presentation. Thank you.
And Senator Von Imhoff did mention she had some comments at the beginning of the meeting, and my exuberance to get rolling, I promptly forgot. So it was good that she reminded me. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Jones. I am the deputy commander for the last 2 years for the opioid epidemic response. I'm also the director for the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention. Before I have my other panelists here present or introduce themselves, the structure for today, it is a long slide deck. I do apologize, but being a comprehensive approach, it really does, it takes a lot of slides to explain the cost. You have a document in front of you that is just as long, but this is designed to be a reference document for afterwards with your staff and that, who can reference this and ask questions afterwards so we can get through this slide deck today. I'll help narrate this process today just because we're going to be kind of going back and forth through the slide decks based off the structure and the request of your letters. And with that, I'll pass it on.
Good morning, Chairman, Senators. Mike Duxbury, Department of Public Safety, Deputy Commissioner, 30-year trooper until recent appointment. What I would like to say is Andy Jones, gal next to me from DOC, one of the things we recognized early on, the only way that we were going to solve this problem in our state and help people and deal with things like Senator Von Imhoff said today, is by collaborating. And so for the last 3 years, we have entered into a collaboration that I think the state would be proud of because of how we've decided to share resources and attack this issue, because we cannot arrest our way out of this problem, but we often have to take approach from all the different angles. So I'll pass it on to Coach Jim.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Laura Brooks. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Corrections Health and Rehabilitation Services. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to share this information with you this morning.
And with that, I'll begin the presentation. Like DC Ducks highlighted, it does take a multi-agency approach. It was one of the first things we realized, eyes wide open from 2017 when we declared this disaster. We started with a couple core state agencies, and by 2018, I had every state agency, to include local unions like the IB or the electrician union, you know, all these different workforce development as part of our response, and continue to this day. It's quite surprising how many players need to be at the table for a response like this. I've served about 15 years doing disaster response, and I've never seen an issue so complex in my life. The way this presentation today is structured is I'm going to give you guys a little bit of overview of the epidemic. We won't go too far into it because I think a lot of us have seen the media and the news about it, but I think the history is important. Our response structure, we'll go into cost association, resources, partnerships, outcomes, results, and then next steps. So on this slide, I think one of the most concerning things every time I look at this slide is that drug overdoses now are the leading cause of death, accidental deaths in the United States. It exceeds automobile accidents. If you look at that third bullet, the other thing that just, it really brings it home for me, being you know, a vet, is that in 2016, drug overdoses killed 65,000 Americans. And if you add up the Vietnam War conflict and the current conflicts in the Iraq and Afghanistan war, we're exceeding those deaths in 1 year's time. And it isn't getting better. The current 2017 deaths have now gone up to 70,237 Americans losing their lives in 1 year. And we've seen a skyrocket in deaths associated with drugs like fentanyl, synthetic opioids, so that would be fentanyl, fentanyl analogs, tramadol. That's now become the most deadly drug in the United States. So these just shows that, you know, it's not getting better. I'd love to show you our results slide, which is last, but Alaska's, I'm optimistic that we're doing okay. We still have a lot of work ahead of us, though. So how did this happen? You know, this problem has been going on for a long time. I'll make this real quick, but I usually will tell the story that it started back in the Civil War. We're always looking for a solution to manage pain. And so in the Civil War, we were using morphine, our medics in the field, and it was to help manage pain, do in-field surgeries. Come to find out, we didn't realize how addictive it was, and it named it the soldier's disease. Following that, a company produced heroin. And this would be a pharmaceutical company, thinking this would be the next new and great pain management tool, and come to find out, just as bad. This trend, I guess the story goes, as this trend continues to go, is we have pain, we're seeking a solution, and unfortunately, a lot of the times, that solution is worse than the other drug. That would be, for example, in the 60s, U4770. I want to thank this group around here who put it on the controlled substance list a couple years ago. That was so addictive, worse than morphine, that a pharmaceutical company pulled it off the market, and unfortunately it went to the black market. So there's this trend. We continue to look at, you know, OxyContin and certain drugs for pain management. We had these new miracle 12-hour slow-release pain management medications, and come to find out they were still being abused. But also tied to that, our medical community, they looked to the pharmaceutical reps, you know, who'd come in. And we assume medical doctors know everything about pain management and addiction, but I think we've come to find out that when they go to medical school, it is about this big. So time-wise, about a week, if that even. I think Dr. Butler told me he took a couple-hour course on it at one time. And so growing up in Soldotna, I remember sitting behind a pharmaceutical, or a pharmaceutical behind a nurse station, and the farm reps coming in and, you know, saying, hey, this is the new stuff. And so there was big lawsuits that were put in place with these pharmaceutical companies because of the misadvertising that came with those drugs. And unfortunately, we're in this state today where opioids are extremely addictive, and our country consumes more opioids than anywhere else in the world. So it's a big problem. One of the fears we have as we're working on our response is the transition from prescription medications over to street drugs, and that is a real problem. It's something we're dealing with actually right now in the South Central area. And so quite often, as we're addressing an issue like this of any drug, the pendulum will swing from one way to the other extremely, and people who can't get their prescriptions for some reason, or people who are even misusing those prescriptions, will seek street drugs. Heroin and opioids are very similar. The difference is that heroin is way cheaper. It's very easy to get, like I said, street price. The danger of it is you don't know what you're getting. I mean, with a prescription medication, you know the potency usually. You can still be abused, but street drugs, the danger is it could be mixed with some very dangerous stuff. And like today we're dealing with is the fentanyl bulking that comes with our heroin a lot of the time. And so those are some of our concerns. As you can see up on the slide deck, it just shows the transition of morphine. Heroin's about 50 times more powerful. Fentanyl's range is between 50 to 100 times more powerful. It just depends on how it's produced. The scary thing with fentanyl is it's a synthetic drug, and so you no longer need an agricultural process to grow it, and it comes a lot quicker, and its potency is very, very powerful.
So through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Duxbury, one of the things that is interesting to us in the opioid fight from the law enforcement is that we deal with folks that are from the Sinaloa or cartels across the Mexican border on a regular basis in Alaska. The reason for that is this is a place where you can make the most money in general to other places when just a small gram, if you took a package of sugar, cut it in four, one of those fours would cost you about $1,000 in some of our cities. So that amount of money that you can make is a marketing scheme that a illicit organization and other organizations use to take advantage of folks, their misery and their pain by marketing heroin, which is just a bit cheaper than the opioids that would be sold or diverted off the market.
So I want to kind of gear this conversation. You'll notice in the topics I use the word polysubstance. Polysubstance just means multiple substances. In our state, I'm going to highlight alcohol is still our biggest problem by far. It is our biggest problem. We're focusing a lot on opioids because the trend in our country in Alaska, we're seeing these sharp trends in deaths occurring, and we want to stop that. But when we have individuals who pass away and we do toxicology reports, most of the times, like it says up there, there's at least three drugs in their bodies. This could be everywhere from marijuana to opioids to alcohol. And so we as a response organization, as a collective group here, we need to start thinking more of a polysubstance response and not just on a sole substance. By focusing on just one substance, we're usually then instantly behind the curve. And so, like we said, fentanyl's moving in. Cocaine's back with a vengeance on the East Coast, making its way to the West Coast, and so we're trying to keep ahead of the trends as much as possible.
And from the law enforcement perspective, one of the interesting outcomes of recent is that fentanyl, which is a more powerful additive, we used to call an adulterant or a cut to drugs than the actual drugs themselves, and it is now being used not only in heroin products, but also in cocaine and methamphetamine.
So we'll talk a little bit about our response structure to remind everybody of what we've been doing for the last 2 years. What you can see up there, the image, that's a incident command system chart. So this is no different than when the earthquake occurred. you stand up an incident command system. Somebody's appointed to be the incident commander of multiple agencies to direct a response. It's very time intensive, but it's very effective in meeting the initial response priorities. I see this epidemic no different than a fire, a flood, or a flu. Dr. Butler served as the incident commander for the last 2 years. I was his deputy IC, but ultimately we all worked together. It was a very collaborative approach. This is just a hierarchical chart. In that chart, we had a multi-agency coordination group, which brought all our departments together, and we used every PIO, public information officer, we could to get the message out. And so this just really highlights our commitment to a multi-agency approach. Just a pretty image right here that just highlights the importance of cross-sectoral collaboration. Like I said, when I first started, we had a couple departments, and it's just gotten bigger and bigger. We don't add people because we think it's great. We add people because we need them there. Department of Administration, for example, they administer our state health insurance, and so we have a capability to look at that insurance, track data, and so those are just some of the examples as we move along. Everybody's got a piece to play in this response. Alaska's framework. So good, bad, or indifferent, many states around the country started out with strategic planning. I'm a responder through and through, and so we had an immediate need. I don't recommend declaring a disaster to the governor because we need to start a planning process. I recommend declaring a disaster because of three elements: loss of life, loss of property, and if the communities exceeded their needs or asking for help. And I could answer all three of those at that time. And so we started out with no strategic plan, really. What we started out with was Dr. Butler's prevention framework, and we really worked on reducing the amount of lice loss, naloxone, education. I mean, I know it was Senator Wilson and Senator Michicki, we were on calls together working with the communities, and so really getting the message out there, reducing the drug demand, building a structure. But in that time, we did have some 100,000-foot high-level documentation that was really important, and that would be the Alaska Opioid Policy Task Force, and they created the recommendations document that was released in 2017. Great document, but not great for the communities. When I said it's really a 100,000-foot level, we built this prevention model, and then we'll talk later on about the statewide opioid action plan. That was a very unique process, something that the country's looking at and asking us a lot of questions. But real short on that is we built it from the ground up. We went to communities, we asked them what their issues were, and we really built a system from the ground up, taking their recommendations. I hate coming into a community and saying, what do you think? Sign off on this. That's not the approach we took, and we'll talk a little more about that.
And as a member of the Opioid Policy Task Force under the last administration, I got exposed to, through DHSS and our work with DOC, a different view of how we could make a difference. And front-loading some prevention and some help and harm reduction on the front end of a law enforcement program seemed to be the best way that we could get the message out to people and also save lives. As a part of Andy's Project Hope, narcotics investigators who typically like to hide behind the curtain and do their job because you can't buy or purchase evidence in a uniform very likely, so we have a tendency to do undercover or plainclothes work. What we ended up doing was taking the individual investigators and reaching out to every community that we could that had police officers that were dealing with this stuff and taught them how to use naloxone. And we had an estimated somewhere around almost 30 lives saved just by police officers. So we understood, again, the mantra that we came with was you can't arrest your way out of this. It has to be a multi-faceted approach. And that is one of the reasons that we took that direction. And it is one of the things that developed the piece of pie in our relationship that we now went to 19 communities with DHSS to listen exactly what people wanted from us as well.
Okay, we have been joined, excuse me, at the beginning of the meeting by Commissioner Designee Nancy Dahlstrom for Corrections and Public Safety Amanda Price. They're both in the audience. One thing I'd like to just add to your comment that what I've seen in my district, some of the less desirable characters are actually going into the village systems where we don't have public safety officers or very concentrated law enforcement just because of the geographical arena, and they're using those points as entry for distribution. So they're the opponents are trying to counter our maneuvers, and be creative. So,
Chair, I agree with your statement there, but one of the things we have to understand is this is an enterprise, a money-making enterprise. It may be somewhat misogynistic in its nature, but it is sucking the money out of our communities as well. So like any enterprise, it is driven by money. We have a hard time getting hold of the money, but it is also an enterprise by which they choose to profit and increase their ability to make an impact on us.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So you mentioned earlier, you said something about taking a gram of sugar and cutting it into fours, and Alaska's more lucrative. Why is Alaska more lucrative than any other state in the lower 48?
It would only be speculation on my part, ma'am, that I understand that. I do understand it only from the fact that I've spent a long time dealing with this, and that we understand it from the, here are the prices they're able to demand in places that are have less actually enforcement around them as well. So it's a very lucrative place to be engaged, something we don't like to advertise, but when we have started to talk about this, we also understood that our efforts collaboratively have also started to make a big impact on their ability to profit off of other people's weakness and misery.
I think the logistical movement, like our regular goods also, you know, that the cost in Alaska overall for a lot of things are expensive. And so same thing with drugs, you know, they just getting the drugs up here takes a lot of time, and there's not a big competing market, let's just say, with other, you know, like there may be in the Chicago-based area and that. And so that's a lot of the times why these substances are so expensive, unfortunately.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
And in addition to what Health and Social Services does, of course, in the community and what law enforcement, what their role is in this, the department recognizes that when we have these individuals, we have a responsibility to respond as well. We have literally a captive audience in our system, and so that is why we've developed a very comprehensive plan to address their substance abuse issues when they're with us. And over the last several years, we've recognized this increase in the opiate effect. And so we've begun to tailor our efforts in custody to make sure that those needs are met when we do have them.
So as we answer and respond to these questions through the chair, it would be helpful to just state your last name in the department you're with for those that happen to maybe tune into the meeting halfway through it, so they keep track of that, and also for the folks that are going to type the minutes after these meetings are done, it'll be helpful. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Brooks. Speaking of DOC in terms of their substance abuse or dealing with the opioid treatment, has DOC begun to start looking at the other methodologies of medication-assisted treatments? And if so, which facilities, how many facilities, just an overview. I just didn't see that in the presentation of going through this presentation. I did see it in the additional documents about sort of the more programmatic aspects of it. And if we can just...
Through the chair to Senator Wilson. Yes.
And you are?
Deputy Director Brooks with the Department of Corrections.
Thank you.
We do have, we have made a concerted effort to focus on medication-assisted treatment. I do have some slides later where I have some additional information on that, but we have begun a Vivitrol program where we administer injections to individuals exiting DOC, returning to the community. And we have also begun methadone bridging so that individuals who come in on methadone, they don't end that treatment when they walk through the door. We have community providers who continue that methadone with us for a limited period of time. And then we are exploring additional avenues to add potentially additional medication-assisted treatment to what we do.
Great. Go ahead and continue.
So this is Andy Jones with the Department of Health, and I'll continue on. So this next part, I just want to highlight that when I started doing this presentation, there is hardly any other state in the country that is tackling trying to put a cost association together. It's so complex. So when we start this, when we talk at least on the health side, we'll talk about substance use disorder in general, because a lot of the time what we try to do is we try to put our funding towards an array of different substance use disorders and not just opioid treatment. This is a great baseline. I know every year, based off SB 91, not the criminal reform, SB 91, the disaster deck, that we have to submit a report to the legislature, and so we'll be continuing to build off this year to highlight the costs that are associated. So with that, I had to put a timeline to this, and I thought it was appropriate to start with 2017 to 2018. That's when the state really ramped up our operations when it came to responding to the epidemic. The areas that we pulled upon was the Department of Health and Social Services Medicaid drug treatment reimbursement claims, the opioid diagnosis claims for Medicaid, the grants that the Division of Behavioral Health pushes out for prevention, treatment, recovery, and associated grants. We looked at hospital discharge data, Department of Corrections funding, Department of Law therapeutic court funding, and public safety drug incidents cost. And with that, here's all our fancy charts. This first chart highlights 2017 and 2018 opioid treatment drug reimbursements in relation to Medicaid. You can probably note, well, in 2017, we had 1,400 recipients who received these medications, and in 2018, we had 2,300 recipients who received these medications. We did see an increase in 2018 by about $1.7 million, and in the category of Suboxone, which is probably one of, I'd say, one of our more popular treatment methods when it comes to substance use disorder. The next slide, broken down by 17, is opioid-related diagnosis reimbursements. On the side with the chart, and I apologize, it's very small writing. It's hard to fit a lot of information into a slide deck here. But I have it broken down into the categories of inpatient treatment, outpatient treatment, professional behavioral health services. These would be things like behavioral health clinics like Rainforest Recovery or Aquila. And then professional general, which may be the individual providers. In 2017, looking at this chart, we had 4,000 Medicaid recipients receiving treatment for opioid-related diagnoses.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This gives a good analysis of what's happening throughout the state, but and I see some other bigger spreadsheets, but how is this disseminated by region of the state? Is there, and more importantly, I think, is there, what is the difference in how extensive the problem may be in Anchorage versus Fairbanks versus Juneau versus Southeast and the rest of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, this is Andy Jones with the Department of Health. I think I got it right there. So these are Medicaid numbers. I don't have the extent of how widespread it is on a map for you right now, but that's something I could follow up and get you, sir, post-meeting today, if that works for you, sir.
Thank you.
Yep.
Senator Machicki.
Question is for whomever takes it, but what are we doing to guard against abuse of the actual treatment drugs, particularly in Department of Corrections? I mean, I don't know that there's a way to quantify the percentage of this cost that's related to internal abuse, but can you comment on that, on your efforts to battle abuse of the actual treatment drugs?
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, this is Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections. So in terms of when somebody comes into our system taking methadone, for example, that's not something that we keep within our system. The community treatment provider brings that every day to the department. So we don't keep any of that medication on site. They bring that in every day and they administer that for us. And so that's one way that we've managed to reduce the abuse within our system. When we're talking about prescription medications for someone who maybe has chronic pain or things like that, we have changed our formulary, so we very rarely prescribe narcotic medications within the Department of Corrections. When we do, it would be for an acute injury or something to address cancer, and that is provided to them only in our infirmary, not in general population. So we have pretty tight controls over that as well.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
This is Andy Jones with the Department of Health, continuing on. So this is FY18 Medicaid diagnosis-related reimbursements. we saw an increase about by $10 million, but we did have about 4,800 Medicaid recipients treated for opioid-related diagnoses. So This could be related to expansion of treatment facilities or capabilities across the state, getting the message out, obviously, and the word about the different forms of treatment, and working to remove the stigma in relation to use, but also in relation to treatment.
So on that slide, if you could help us, there, it looks like it went from 20 point, or almost 21 million rounded off to 30.1 million in 1 year. In total cost, what are you expecting coming at us for the next few years?
You know, I...
you don't have to...
Yeah, I was going to say, sir, you know, my analysis would be that the drug problem is going to continue to... I mean, it's always it's a moving cycle. So if it's not opioids, it's going to be some other. So, but I would have to say I'd either have to call on my behavioral health specialist behind me or the director for behavioral health if you'd like that answered, or we could get it offline for you.
We'll get it offline. We'll keep going. Should we stay on track?
So this is just shows you guys the Medicaid diagnosis reimbursement. I just put both together so you could see the increase in costs.
Okay, Senator Wilson, you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, on the previous slide, we talked look at the federal funding aspects, and we know that HRSA, CDC, SAMHSA, a couple other federal agencies have given the state funding or the funding opportunities available for the state. Has the state applied for the majority of those funds? What is the percentage of those funds are actually utilized? And do we ever return any of those funds back for unspent needs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, this is Andy Jones, Department of Health. Great question. We, in the last 2 years, I'd have to go back and look at my slides at the end here, but I want to say we're at $35 million that we have received in federal grant funds. We are applying for, I'm not going to say every grant, but we are looking at every single grant that's out there, and then as a collective group, we decide on, does it work for Alaska? Could it work for our communities? And then, if so, we apply for it. Turning money back. You know, some of these grants have extremely short cycles. For example, our CDC grant is a one-year spending cycle, which is extremely hard to get the money received into the state. So I wouldn't say we've turned money back, but we do request extensions to move them funding into the next year, no-cost extensions, which we've been very successful with. The goal for us is to get most all this funding out, and of that $35 million, I don't have the percentages break down, but it does span between enforcement in relation to, like, the high-intensity drug trafficking area to the Department of Corrections with their reentry programs, and then obviously with the Department of Health and prevention and treatment grants.
Well, I could, Mr. Chair, can we hear that from some of the rest of the departments to see if they have utilized their funding appropriately or have returned funding back from the troopers and corrections as well?
Yes.
The only thing I can...
If you could identify yourself first.
This is Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, Department of Public Safety. And I have a lifeline behind me that is more aware of how we have utilized the money. But in my experience with cooperation and collaboration with DHSS and DOC, that we have, to my knowledge, utilized cross-funding facilities to help us do business. I am not aware of what we may have turned back, if we have turned back any from federal funding that was specific for opioids.
You can get back to the committee on that finer point on the response.
Yes, I can, sir.
Yep.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections. Our primary federal funding that we have for substance abuse treatment is a grant for our residential treatment programs. And that has been, it's through the Bureau of Justice Assistance. And this last year, they added a requirement that if we were going to apply for that grant again, we had to apply for a greater amount for that grant, because that additional amount is dedicated to opioid treatment. So that's the primary federal grant that we have for substance abuse treatment. We do continue to look at other grant opportunities. In the last couple of years, though, we did receive quite a bit of funding from the state to enhance and grow our substance abuse treatment programs. So we haven't quite yet started up looking at those other federal grant opportunities, because we've been working very hard to grow those programs. And that has been very challenging in some areas, just because of the amount of resources in the community. And so that's been our primary focus for about the last 2 years.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health, continuing. So this was just the slide up here that shows the 2 years in comparison. On to the next category, treatment, recovery, prevention, and intervention grants for 17 and 18. The state costs and the federal cost, we use these grants mostly, are designed to get entities and organizations up and running. And then eventually, once they're up and running, if they have the capacity, transition them to that fee for service or billing for Medicaid. And so this allows us to continue to build a capability. My biggest fear when it comes to federal grants and sending them to the local jurisdictions is making sure, is it sustainable? The last thing I want to do is throw federal funding into a local jurisdiction, and that's what they're solely relying on. And they then, once it dries up, the capability dries up. It's kind of false hope, I think, to a community. These community grants have supported 17,000, well, I'll round up, 18,000 recipients. Of those 18,000, when we talk about these grants are designed for substance use disorders as whole. So it's not just opioid treatment, but as we're dealing with this epidemic, there's a lot of co-occurring disorders that occur, and so we like to build capabilities that are broad, that are multifaceted. And so of those 17,000, roughly 2,000 were treated for opioid-related substances like fentanyl, heroin, or U4. So that's these slides right here.
Senator
from Bethel.
And then we'll go down to the senator from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that you're concerned about ramping up and not having the funds to sustain them. You know, I think the people of Alaska are probably less concerned about that. The chairman asked about future funding. And if this truly is an epidemic, what is the path forward to identify the epidemic, turn this around, and reverse the flow so that the epidemic does not continue? You know, I think that is the bigger question, not whether or not these programs are sustainable. We have an epidemic at hand, and the people of Alaska need to know how the state of Alaska is going to be addressing this, how are we going to turn the corner, and how are we going to make Alaskans safe in this abuse of opioids. That is the primary concern, not whether or not these programs are sustainable.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, thank you for that. And I have a slide here at the end where I was going to kind of talk about our result. And then I feel like, well, I'd like to, if we could wait till that point, we could talk about maybe turning this tide. Fingers crossed, but once we go to that slide, things are looking good right now at this point at some of the numbers that are occurring. So if that's okay with you, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any statistics on the effectiveness of the various treatments that are being provided?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is Andy Jones, Department of Health. I don't have that on me right now, but I'll make sure to provide that to you post-meeting.
You'll provide it to the committee and we'll disperse it amongst the members?
Yes, sir.
Senator Wilson and Senator McChicky?
Yeah, just following up on Senator from Bethel's question in terms of programs ramping up with grant disposal versus fee-for-service. A couple of years ago, or a few cycles back, the Department of Behavioral Health sort of stopped the grant funding for a lot of behavioral health substance abuse centers and had them go for the fee-for-service. When expansion kicked in, a lot of them had difficulties keeping up with the billing. A lot of them weren't able to still bill for those services. We don't know if billing has sort of offset the grant match in some of these agencies, and most of these agencies had to close up shop. I mean, agencies have closed in Fairbanks, agencies have closed in Kenai. We've lost three in the Mat-Su because of sort of the grant funding has shrunk down to a point that they can't sustain sort of the larger issue with substance abuse and issues. Are we looking at reversing that sort of trend in grant funding for these agencies to keep up sort of the demand and pace and the backlog of 2 to 3 weeks of folks as well? I just wanted to understand how the grant funding for fee-for-service is still working out and working within the Department of Behavioral Health. And, Mr. Chair, I know that's a large answer, and if the department can just get back to us, I'll appreciate that.
You can help the Senator with a brief answer to that, and if you want to go into more detail to bring it back to the committee.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, Andy Jones, Department of Health. If it's okay, I'd like to bring that to the committee later so I can work with our Director of Behavioral Health on that answer.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Senator McChicky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like the effectiveness in an epidemic response, whether it's biological or behavioral, is getting ahead of the curve before it gets ahead of you. And my question is, on the Medicaid treatment options, we increased funding by 50% in 1 year between FY17 and FY18, but the grant funding is actually reduced. Could you explain that relationship and why we don't have a better response federally on the grant funding options?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, if you'd like, I could bring up our Director of Behavioral Health who could answer these questions to the committee right now, if that's okay with you, sir.
Unless it's better to wait toward the end, that's whatever you think is most effective.
You could introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and help Senator Machicki with his question, please.
Sure. Hi, my name is Jennifer Moreau, and I am the Acting Director for the Division of Behavioral Health. So through the chair, your question relates to the reduction in grants and the increase in Medicaid expenditures specific to substance use, misuse disorder. There has been an ongoing effort to increase federal funding. And the best way to do that we determined through SB 74 was to kind of incrementally decrease the grant funding and support agencies to bill Medicaid for substance misuse disorder. We've been attempting to do that through providing technical assistance to agencies to become Medicaid billers and through a long process of negotiating with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services for our Section 1115 waiver for the demonstration project to reboot and enhance the behavioral health system.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
I was a co-sponsor of Senate Bill 74. We just wondering, we only see between the 2 years a $10 million increase, and it's largely because of Medicaid. Was it the correct approach? Are we leaving money on the table that we could be using, as Senator Hoffman said, to get ahead of this today?
Through the chair, I don't know that I can answer if it was the correct approach. What I can tell you is that the negotiation with CMS is long and arduous and probably took longer than we anticipated. The good news that I can offer is that we did in November receive approval from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services for the substance use disorder component of the Section 1115 demonstration project. What that means might be a little anticlimactic, because really what that allows us to do is then get our implementation plan approved, so that the implementation plan for the substance use disorder component of the 1115 is due on February 19th. So that's, I think, when the rubber starts to meet the road, and hopefully we can start to get some traction through the Medicaid financing.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go ahead and continue with the presentation.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health, continuing presentation. So this just correlates with the figures that you guys saw on the previous slide, 2017 grant funds. I like images, and so this just gives you a representation of where the grant funds go. This does not represent all the services that are available statewide. This is just in relation to our grant funding. So there are quite a few other existing services in relation to our tribal or private partnerships that are out there. This just also shows for your reference the 18 grants and where funding's going across the state with the in relation to grant funding through DBH for treatment, or for treatment, recovery, prevention, and intervention.
Back up for a minute on slide 18. Can you help me understand, you know, we have treatment and recovery, we got $3.4 million in Bethel, yet when I look down to Ketchikan at $1 million, Sitka at $1 million, Petersburg at 900, and I try to think in the top of my head the population base of those communities. It doesn't seem to correlate very well. Ketchikan with and Metlakatla would have 13, maybe 14,000 people. Sitka's got 9, and then I don't know off the population offhand in Bethel, but it's Could you help me with that, Senator from Bethel?
I could help greatly with that. Mr. Chairman, those of you at the table that know the Bethel region comprises of an area that is larger than the state of Washington, Mr. Chairman. And it has some 56 communities throughout this region that provide services. And one of the largest problems in delivery of services is transportation and getting information out there. So you look at Western Alaska and Bethel, what it serves, you don't look at Bethel proper. You look at all 56 villages and the nonprofits in that service the region. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is by far the largest corporation in rural Alaska. So I would like you, Mr. Chairman, to come out with me sometime and we could travel that region. I know your co-chairman has been out there extensively.
No, the question wasn't slanted to an overweighting of appropriations into Bethel. The question is it doesn't seem to correlate with a population basis very well. And if we could maybe have some assistance with that. I recognize that Bethel has a regional area, not much dissimilar than Sitka-Bringen and its regional villages and Ketchikan, its regional villages. But it just doesn't seem to, seems kind of odd, the expenditures relative to the population, and maybe you could come back with a rough population breakdown. And it drives to the earlier question that does Senator Hoffman have is the regional distribution relative to population. We're trying to get a handle on it. I wasn't targeting Bethel for excessive expenditures. That wasn't the point of the question.
They still, Mr. Chairman, they still don't have adequate expenditures to address the problem, and I think that exists throughout the state of Alaska, and that is why we have the epidemic.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. So if you could come back with some population comparisons, we want to try to get a feel for, where the, effort needs to be, is being concentrated or what have you. Senator Wilson.
And Mr. Chair, and the department might be able to answer this, but I think that some of the DBH grant funding is just you can apply for a base amount funding before an entity is able to bill for services as well, and that sometimes departments just sometimes give grants, smaller grants out to other communities for the ability to bill for substance abuse and other treatment type of situations.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
I think the larger question is how is the funding distributed, if we could have a better understanding of that proportionally. Is it related to population? Is it related to the difficulty of delivering services? If we can understand that, I think it'd be a better answer.
And then also, if you could add to that kind of your feel for the weighting of the issue in the area of the substance abuse. I'm hoping that some areas of the state are substantially lighter than others. That may not be the but go ahead and continue.
Thank you, sir. So the next slide is therapeutic courts. I have our Department of Law rep here for additional questions, but we were able to highlight 17, 18, and 19 for therapeutic courts. Services provided is not just a opioid-related court, but it's drug courts, DUI courts, mental health courts, family courts. What I've been told, and I've actually had the opportunity to see, is these are very, very expensive but highly effective. And so I've actually sat in quite a few of these in the Palmer area, and I think this is an extremely important aspect to our response as we move along.
Okay.
Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections. So as I mentioned, we are in kind of a unique position to address substance abuse needs of Alaskans, and the department has put together a pretty comprehensive substance abuse treatment program throughout our system. They serve all types of addictions, but we have identified that about a third of those have opioid use disorders. And so this slide represents the amount of money that really goes to that specific area and that specific part of treatment. You can see about 830,000 general funds, and that goes again into our residential programs, our intensive outpatient programs, psychoeducation, assessment, and also towards our MAT programs, our medication-assisted treatments. In 2017, we received funding through SB 91 to enhance our substance abuse services system-wide. And so a large part of those funds went towards opioid treatment. We hadn't really had a dedicated effort specific to any particular area of substance use. So we expanded substance abuse services in all areas, but a priority focus went to opioid treatment. And so you can see here that it's broken down into two areas, institutional programming, and then for individuals who are out in our halfway houses out in the communities. And so that's really where we turned our efforts, and that is how we were able to fund the medication-assisted treatment programs throughout our system. And then the last section of there, of course, is the federal grants, which I did address previously.
Nice. Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question here on FY17. My understanding is the Department of Corrections did not have a contract provider to provide substance abuse treatment in the facility, so I don't understand where this, if they can have a breakdown of those costs and where that money actually went to, without them having for about 18 months, they did not have a contract provider to provide substance abuse treatment through all the facilities throughout DOC. So if we can just get a list of what facilities treatment provider was provided to over the time span of 17, 18 and going on would be really helpful for.
Could you provide that to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Duxbury of the Department of Public Safety. This graph here shows that a component of the opioid drug use is also a component of the poly drug use problem that we have in Alaska that is a legacy, and we've already talked about alcohol being one of the largest parts of that problem. Here you'll see co-located on this chart the fact that both methamphetamine and heroin are opioids are one of our biggest issues in the state of Alaska. On a regular basis, when our folks doing investigations are investigating any of the drug trafficking and interacting with folks, we see co-located on a regular basis often methamphetamine about five times as much as heroin in almost every instance that we deal with in drug trafficking. This shows you the map started from, on the chart, started from 2010 to 2018.
Could you help me with it looks like 18's decline.
So this is an interesting fact. What we are able to actually interdict and interact with is a component of how many people I have that are capable of doing the job, how much time, money, and energy that we have based on what other investigations are going on. And what we see is not always indicative of what is available to the public that has come in. Interdictions are something that we've had to go to in the last couple of years as the mainstay for doing drug enforcement work because some of our options were limited in recent legislation, mainly SB 91.
Right, but that wasn't my question. You're jumping the gun previously here a few minutes ago. There was an increase in, substantial increase, at least it appeared by reading the papers and talking to law enforcement in Southeast, Ketchikan as a standout. And I would expect if we saw those numbers in Southeast and Ketchikan, it would be increasing, not decreasing. They've had some pretty substantial arrests and activity, which is very good. And it just seems to be contrary to the overall numerics here. Can you help us with that at all or get back to the committee on the regions of the state?
I think, sir, that you see this as an overall state of Alaska perspective, and yes, we could get back with you, and also some of the constraints that I have are also open cases not fully adjudicated because drug investigations are intensive, long-term issues on a regular basis. So I will endeavor to get back with the committee with a regional basis.
Because, quite frankly, you guys have been doing a really good job in Southeast interdicting and dealing with this issue. And they've had some pretty large articles in the newspaper down here on the subject.
Chairman, Mike Duxbury again. This is the Department of Public Safety opioid incident cost, and this is an average based on what it costs us to do an investigation up to the point of arrest. This is information that was helped derived by a study done through the University of Alaska, and they took the components of everybody that's involved in making the arrest, and DOC is a part of that system, and in 2017 came up with a basic what does it cost per incident. However, this does not take into account that we may have had a traffic stop and an arrest involved opioids, or we may have had a year or longer investigation and that opioid investigation had multiple individuals and cost maybe a lot more. So this is an average price.
Could you, before you jump on, could you help the committee with the VSBO program? Some of the areas do not have and would like to have village public safety officers representation, and how is all of the areas that are either covered by village public safety officers or not and would like to be out, how is that taken account in the data here?
The VPSO program is an oversight program that the Alaska State Troopers have. So they are not state employees. They are village public safety officers run through their different components for the different regions. When we have a case that involves felony amount of effort that has been determined that was the incident was a felony amount, then the Alaska State Troopers have purview and oversight over that case and take on that investigation. I cannot necessarily address the specific question about what VPSOs would like or don't have or what villages don't have in their areas, but I can tell you that anytime we're involved in a felony drug investigation, which most of them happen to be, that it is an Alaska State Trooper that takes over that, and that's where we would capture this, their numbers within this system.
And we have Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. The VPSO program, the Alaska Village Public Safety Program, is providing public safety on behalf of the state of Alaska. It is a responsibility of the state of Alaska. It just so happens that the state has contracted with nonprofits to provide public safety in these areas of the state. But let it be known that the responsibility of public safety in these areas, although contracted, is the responsibility of the state of Alaska.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was, I was looking at the back of the slides, and now's a good time for me to ask my question. We spend over $50 million on the front end trying to fix these folks after they've, for maybe no fault of their own, got addicted, and yet it appears to me that we've got 41 people in law enforcement that are dedicated to stopping the problem. What if we were to put $50 million into these 41 officers and make it 141 to stop it on the front end, so we're not having a problem on the back end? Have you thought about that, or just a
through the chair, Senator, I think we could throw money at this problem at this point in time in our history, and it wouldn't necessarily solve the issue. I have an empathy and a real sympathetic issue with, we have to look at two things here. One is, you can't arrest your way out of this, is also part of being compassionate towards people that have gotten into an addiction situation that need the help. And I think the money we spend there is important. I think you're right that doing things on the front end would be save a lot of money on the back end. But as much as people would like to say that drug enforcement is proactive, it is still reactive to the issue. And it is still dependent on human nature. And I would revert back to a comment made by the chairman earlier. It is absolutely correct. And that is human nature. They're going to look for other ways to get around us. This will always be an issue that we would chase, no matter how much money we put at it, and we have to come at it from the collaborative perspective that we have been. We have to have folks on DHSS helping us, and the medical community, We have to have people from DOC. We have to have almost everybody in our state has to come together to see their part that's part of helping keep Alaskans happy, healthy, and whole so they can prosper and be available to be productive citizens, sir.
Mr. Duxbury, could you identify yourself just so they keep track of the minutes? Can you identify yourself?
Yes, sir. This is Deputy Commissioner Michael Duxbury.
I've made the last comments. We have a question from Senator Wilkowski, and then but before we go there, did you have a follow-up, Senator Bishop?
I did, just briefly. So then it's just an observation on my point. I go back and forth on this. When Pablo Escobar was caught, he had $50 billion in the bank buried, and they're still digging it up, right? So war on drugs hasn't worked. I appreciate your comment. So then that goes back to the next, it's just a comment. So maybe we look at legalizing it.
Okay, we'll move on here. I don't think we're going to legalize it. We're going to add more police and drug enforcement issues to the budget coming up, even though the budget's going to get a slim fast diet. We're going to have more troopers on the ground. Senator Wilkowski and then Senator Wilson.
Yeah, and just on the point that was made by Senator Bishop, you stated in the beginning that opioids are how we deal with pain, and that's absolutely true. I don't think we have more pain in this state or in this country than other states or other countries. It's just the way that we are dealing with it, or that people deal with it culturally, societally. And if it's not opioids, it's going to be alcohol. If it's not alcohol, it'll be something else. And so I think what I'd like to see more, and I think what I agree with Senator Bishop, it's a bigger problem. We've got to get to the fundamental root of why are people choosing to deal with their pain in this manner, and how do we address the root causes of this? And I don't know if there's research. There must be research in other countries, other states. It's just how people are dealing with pain societally. And I don't know if you have a comment on that or if that's being addressed in other ways, but I agree. I mean, we need law enforcement, we need corrections, but I don't see anyone from the education community here, and maybe they weren't invited, but that seems to me like a fundamental component of this is just how people are dealing with this issue of pain.
You can help him. I don't really see a question, but if you can help him with his statement.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So upstream prevention is a big focus of ours.
And you are?
Andy Jones, Department of Health and Social Services. Yeah. Going to get this right one of these days. Upstream prevention is a big focus of ours right now. You know, we are losing a generation of people. So you're right. There's the biological, the environmental, and the social factors that are all caused here. So we've taken away education. You know, we had the DARE campaign, good, bad, or indifferent, but we're looking at, you know, new programs, and we're partnering with the Department of Education, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and the DPS, and looking at programs that have great return on investment, teaching our kids, you know, life skills, teaching them how to make proper decisions. Also, you know, adverse childhood experiences, starting to address those factors that are within our community. So these are the things we're starting to look at. We've been, we sent a group last year with Dr. Butler to Iceland to look at the Icelandic model. I can send the committee a one-pager on that model, and there are some boroughs that are looking to implement factors of that, and they've seen great results. But anything that we do with upstream prevention, it takes time. But with time and the commitment and the funding, you usually do see results, and you do see, you know, that turn. So I'll make sure to follow up and send some of those documentation, sir.
Senator Wilson, and then we're going to have to get back on track and off of philosophy, or we won't get done today.
Back on the presentation, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions here. The first one is Department Attachment B, looking at this slide and the next slide, seems like ASD Detachment B is sort of an outlier. What detachment is that?
Detachment B would be the Matsu Borough, sir.
Okay, thank you. And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I don't know if we have anyone on the Department of Law that can talk about in the response, maybe it's later in the presentation, to talk about where the state is and the ongoing lawsuit that the state has entered into against the pharmaceutical entities?
Right, at some point, but kind of let's stay on track here, and then we'll get an update on that potential litigation, unless it's covered in your presentation.
Chairman,
go ahead and continue.
Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, we do have someone here available at after the end of this thing that may be able to provide some more insight on that.
Right. I want to stay on track because we've burned over a little over half our time, and we're on slide 23.
I would like to, Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, I'd like to present this slide as just a juxtapose and contrast to the opioid issue. As you can see here, is almost three times as much in terms of money that was spent on methamphetamine.
And if you could tell us where these detachments are, I think that was pointed out earlier. So
A detachment would be your southeast area. The B detachment would be essentially the Mat-Su area, but wider. C detachment is most of western Alaska. D detachment is the Fairbanks area and some of the outlying villages. E detachment is your peninsula and from Soldotna, Kenai area. And then AWT North Detachment covers the northern part of the state for Alaska Wildlife Troopers. AWT Directors Detachment South is for the southern section below, I believe, from Valdez below. And AWT Director's Office as self-explanatory, as are the rest, I believe.
Okay, and if you can come back to the committee with the version two of these slides with some brief description off of the titles, because the average guy that reads these would have no clue.
Okay. We can do that, and we'll get back with the committee.
All right. Probably the entire committee.
Thank you.
Can we have a quick question from Senator Machado?
Very quick on this slide. Please also explain the distribution from the ABI throughout the state. I assume there's some crossover there.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, there has been a change from 2010 to 2018 in what ABI actually was considered. Right now it is a statewide agency that provides investigative service throughout the state. That does not include, beforehand did not include the statewide drug enforcement unit, but at this point in time it is under one supervision. So we'll try to give you some more insight into that.
And you are again?
Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury.
Thank you.
This next slide is an attempt to tell we've given you some information on what it costs to arrest somebody and what it costs to do an investigation in general. However, it is very difficult for us to enumerate how many times that we arrived at a burglary, so to speak, and it had a component to it that was based on drug use or drug trafficking or opioid use. Here you see in the National Drug Threat Survey in 2016 that they claim that the property crime percentages are 35% attributed to heroin and 27% attributed to methamphetamine. How that equates to the state of Alaska is, as the sites previous to this now have demonstrated, is we have a significant issue on both of those controlled illicit substances. And it would not be correct to assume that what we showed you in how much it cost us to arrest a person in an investigation to actually equate that with how much it costs the state to take care of and respond to, especially from the Department of Public Safety to the opioid crisis. Again, this is just showing that the survey, same survey, drug and violent crime related to over a third of the crimes in the nation were related to methamphetamine that were violent crimes, and 20.2% were related to heroin. Again, helps us demonstrate that we may show up at an assault after the fact, and the person that's a victim may have no clue whether or not it was driven by, but the percentages seem to show, based on what we have as issues in the poly drug use in the state, that a good percentage of our crimes would be driven by a similar factor. And therefore, it would be very difficult for us to enumerate how much it really costs the state of Alaska, the Department of Public Safety, to engage in response to the opioid crisis.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health and Social Services. So slide 27 highlights the total costs of the categories that we just went through. And so this is for 2017. State's share, total cost was $101 million. State share was $70 million, and the federal share is $30 million of that cost. In 18, we saw an increase of about $8 million, same categories. State share was $70 million. Federal share was roughly $39 million for a total of $109 million dollars. So,
Senator Von Imhoff, you have a question?
Well, yes, and I'll make it quick. I just thank you for showing this again. I'm just going to emphasize it's not really a question, but if there's later on in the slides or if it needs to be a supplemental, in the light of limited state resources that we know it's coming up, of all of these programs, which one works the best? I mean, I'm sure there's like 8 or 9 bullet points under each one of these programs. I'm sure hopefully there's going to be an evaluation and the really, really tough decisions of prioritizing which programs give us the best bang for the buck and then actually gripping your stomach and saying we have to eliminate a few programs that may still help some people, but we have to help the greatest number of people with the greatest effect with our limited dollars. That's sort of a one way to look at it, but we have to look at it some way because we're, like we said, or like Mr. Sedman said, we've got a slim, fast diet coming up.
Well, we've got, just for those watching at home, Senator Von Imhoff is subcommittee chairman of the health and budget coming up. So it'd be preferred to rank those. I think the departments are ranking a lot of their stuff, but it'd be nice if the three of you could get together and try to rank it and make it easier for us to get the best bang for a buck out of the budget.
Through the chair, Andy Jones, Department of Health. We'll get that list together and send it to you.
Go ahead and continue.
So the next slide, it just took the 2 years and created a total cost, $210 million. In this lengthy document, the 47-page document, I think it's attachment 14, explains the various services that are provided. Between just 2017 and 18, 26,000 recipients were treated for opioid-related diagnoses. 3,700 recipients received opioid treatment medications, and there was about 1,700 opioid-related instances occurred with DPS in relation.
Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, because we're all public safety and public servants in general, I think it would be remiss if we didn't bring up some other aspect of what it does cost us in Alaska. And utilizing the 2017 UCR reporting, to the best of that ability, which is limited in how it is reported, the estimated cost to the public for the issues related to crime and the opioid crisis was $60,750,667. And we just wanted to make that as that is another issue of a component of response, because those are people that would like us to be successful in the way we address this issue.
Okay.
So this is Andy Jones, Department of Health and Social Services, slide 30. We're moving into resources now. So prevention. One of the prevention grants that are extremely important to us is Partnerships for Success. Many of the communities have a Partnerships for Success, like Sitka, the Kenai Peninsula Borough. These coalitions bring together multiple different agencies, community members to focus on certain topics. The current grant focuses on the opioid epidemic, but we, in partnership with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, who received a new Partnerships for Success grant, are focusing on alcohol also. So these are great groups that then we can partner to get things like naloxone, drug disposal bags out, you know, and really start to focus on kind of the upstream prevention aspects that we've been talking about. There are local task forces, and I'll show that on the next slide, that have become extremely powerful. There's a book out there called Dreamland, if you haven't read it, and the author highlights that isolation fuels addiction. It's community that provides the cure. And with these coalitions or these task forces that are stood up in these communities, I'm seeing a lot of progress made, and they're advancing quite a bit more than maybe some of the other communities. So it takes all of us. Within the state government, the Division of Behavioral Health, the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention also provides resources to the community, support to the community. We try to be in the prevention world as transparent as possible. We have data dashboards to show the public of what's currently going on. That's an image of it. And we've also created a webpage, Opioids in Alaska webpage, that in this very large document, reference document, has the link for you guys. It's a tool that talks about the data, supporting the family, resources for providers. We continue to learn, and as we're learning, we're building these resources out more and more and more. And so we're right now at this point making a restructure of that website.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, Department of Public Safety. One of the things that we realized as the Department of Public Safety, too, is that prevention is also should be part of the component that we do in this collaboration. And one of the things that we managed to do is to take these bags that are biodegradable, that don't have to allow or make people wait for a yearly take back on drugs. If 75 to 80%, and that is an arguable number, of people utilizing heroin or opioids illicitly came from a diverted medication, we are now making it available in every one of our posts that somebody can come in and say, I need to get this out of my medicine cabinet so my kids don't have access to it, or somebody who's having a struggle doesn't have access to it. So Department of Public Safety as well as DOC are all looking at prevention. So addressing some of the concerns that were said here, it's a multi-faceted approach and we're all involved.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health. Slide, moving on with presentation, slide 31. So community coalitions, this just highlights some of the various community coalitions that we work with. Having a point of contact in the community like this, instead of having to go to 20 different providers, 20 different individuals, this really does help us. Plus, these are the leaders in the community who then we're force multiplying. I have an office of 8 people. So it's hard to serve every single person, but by having this force multiplying effect, we're able to really serve the state in a better way. This slide, you have a expanded version, I think, printed out for you. I know we are limited on time, but it just highlights some of the grants. This is from last year, and this is not just opioid treatment. It's the broad look at prevention and intervention. So I just wanted you guys to have a view of this. This doesn't represent all prevention that takes place, only the grants that are delivered. So this slide talks about treatment. And it on the bottom there shows you an image of the continuum of care in relation to opioid or substance use disorder. And in these categories, I just want to highlight for detox or withdrawal management, we have 4 locations within the state: Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Soldotna. When it comes to medication-assisted treatment, we have over 300 prescribers currently in our state. These could be an individual physician who can then prescribe a certain medication out to an individual. Of those 300 prescribers, that doesn't mean they're all actively prescribing. I think would say about half of them at this point, but this is one of the areas we're working to expand. Inpatient residential treatment, currently we're at nearly 300 beds in the state. Transitional housing, we're continuing to build that capacity. Transitional housing, a lot of these individuals, as their minds are rewired, they lose all connection in their community, having a place to live and rebuild, a place that's healthy too. You know, a recovery residence has been a big success. We've seen it in the Mat-Su Valley with organizations like Fiend to Clean, CITC, here in Juneau, Juneau Haven House. So these have been extremely powerful, and it's a way that the community can implement something pretty quick. Outpatient, for substance use disorder, there's about 30 programs, but if you have the blended programs and resources, there's about over 100 programs statewide. Reentry services, these are designed for individuals who are gonna be formerly incarcerated to reenter into their communities and get the services that they may need to have a successful transition. We currently have about 9 locations statewide. And then the last service is peer recovery support services. As I've been in this job, I think this is one of the most critical aspects that we are working to build upon right now. Is what we've learned is that Andy Jones can have only so much of a relationship with somebody who may be actively using or who was using, but an individual who's gone through this experience, who has a lived experience, has a better connection. And we're seeing success with helping in the continuum of care, so being that guardian angel that kind of guides them through this very complex system.
We have Senator Bishop and then Senator Wilson.
What's the success rate
For treatment?
For treatment for
her. I don't have, through the chair, Senator Bishop, this is Andy Jones, Department of Health. I don't have that number on me right now, but I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. You know, medication-assisted treatment and peer recovery support services have been one of the most effective ways of getting someone through treatment. And peer recovery support services, New York, Louisiana, have done a good job with this in terms of our felons or reentry programs or folks that are normally sometimes past felons. Is Department of Corrections, parole, are you looking at sort of taking that stigma off of reentry folks that they can associate with past felons in terms of that may be sort of peer recovery support folks?
Through the chair, Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections. We have implemented several peer support programs within our system. I don't know right now exactly what the if policies have changed to address what you're asking, but I can certainly find that out for you. But we have, over the last 2 years, turned a definite focus to back onto peer supports in that effort, both in our institutions and in the community.
Okay, you guys are okay on time. I'm watching the clock for you. Just keep rolling. If we get behind a little bit, I'll flag you.
Thank you, sir. This is Andy Jones, Department of Health, slide 34, moving on. So I think just with this slide, I want to say that in the 2 years overseeing the response, we are making stride. We are building capability, and we're trying to do it as best as we can appropriately because we need to build from the front end, meaning detox, but we got to make sure we're building on the back end with recovery services. If we build on one end, it's unbalanced, so we just need to be very careful about that. These are the treatment and recovery grants from last year. Once again, I think you have a bigger version of this at your table, but it just highlights where some of the different services are in the state. This only represents the grant funding, and it's a broader spectrum of services. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to DC Ducks.
Through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, Department of Public Safety. This is a slide just to illustrate the situation that we have in the statewide drug enforcement unit. It is supervised under one captain in the Anchorage office, along with the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, but acts as a independent unit. Under AS 1865085A, B, C, narcotics and drug and alcohol enforcement is where we get our mandate to engage in drug and alcohol enforcement. One of the issues with us is that we are a small unit and we incorporate ourselves and become task force officers with many of the other agencies within the state that are federal agencies that are our partners, not only with federal agencies but also local state agencies as well as the local police departments.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you provide the committee with the number of cases that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years? Particularly, if you have the numbers for last year, that would be great. Do you know what those are? How successful is the unit?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we can get you some of those numbers that involve the cases that are closed and have been adjudicated and that we have worked on in the last year. We have been working pretty heavily in the interdiction area, which means we understand that this is not a production state, that all drugs come here to get distributed to other places, and we work really heavily on those issues. And we'll work to get you that information at the
later. And if you could make it by region, your regions that you had on the earlier slide, your detachments or what have you, would be helpful.
And Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could have it broken down by narcotics and alcohol as well, because in rural Alaska, alcohol abuse is probably more prevalent and more of a problem than narcotics, although that is changing.
If you could parse out alcohol, that would be helpful.
Chairman, that is possible, and we will get that to the committee afterwards.
Yes.
Here is a map that shows the location of where we have actual Alaska State Troopers and coalition of local and federal teams located.
On the access into the Marine Highway, I see you know the Ketchikan detachment down there gets a lot of, I guess, frontline activity from imports from south, at least water-wise. How do we tighten up access to the Marine Highway for drug transportation, forcing them either to try to drive through Canada and go through customs, which they probably wouldn't be very successful at, I would think, or by air, so we can then monitor the airports?
There, There are a number of ways that that might happen, sir, and presently we have been designated as a HIDA, a high-intensity drug trafficking area designation, the first one in, I think, 17 years in the United States. That is very important to us because it will bring us resources that we can expand upon the efforts that we are making now, and it also helps us enjoin a number of different smaller places and communities that have smaller departments to work with us by providing monetary resources as well. There is a plan to, under what is known as CCAD, the Southeast Area Cities Against Drugs program, to bolster that and to do exactly what you were talking about.
Right. I think a lot of us would like to see a drug-sniffing dog like they have in the airports in Bellingham for the Marine Highway boardings, things of that nature. You see the drug dogs in the airports quite often.
Chairman, it is an interesting suggestion that you make and is worth looking at. We have had programs similar to that in the past, and we can investigate doing that as well as in the future.
Yes. Senator Von Emmer.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So one of the reasons of having the three agencies here was to sort of show a cooperation or almost a flow of activity that may occur between the three or more. For example, Chair Stedman brings up a point about drugs coming into the state. So you kind of show this cartoon, if you will, a drugs coming into Ketchikan. Then where does it go? Well, that's DOT. Now all of a sudden it goes to the hands of a dealer. There's your DPS. Now it goes to the hands of people who are buying it. Then they have an overdose. Okay, so DPS comes in, or maybe then they get arrested, then they go to corrections, or they may seek drug treatment. And so what I wanted to see is how you communicate and how you say, I have this person here, and this is how he got the drugs, and then this is what are we going to do with this person, and kind of show the different paths of how these programs are interacting with one another. And you're doing a really good job listing all the different programs, but I don't see how they're not relating, or I'm not seeing that yet. And so I don't know if we can, if you can mention that in the last 30 minutes.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, this is Andy Jones, Department of Health. So one of the scenarios, you're right, we definitely interact, and apologies we don't have that, we haven't said it out loud, but one of the scenarios I can highlight for you is within the Department of Public Health, the Division of Public Health, a lot, we work with the needle exchange sites throughout Anchorage, Fairbanks. These are the individuals who are directly using. And so one of the tacks we've taken is those spent needles, they're shipped, some of them are shipped over to our public health lab. Those blood product on those are tested for us using federal dollars, not state dollars. That then tells us what's on the street, and then I can go to Commander or Deputy Commissioner Duxbury and say, hey, Dux, I'm noticing that we're starting to see these trends of drugs. Have you guys seen this? And they may say no. And this then helps them focus their efforts as we're still working with the individual who may be suffering from using. And so we're exploring a lot of these options, how we work together. It is a very new concept for law enforcement, I would say, in public health to be, or health as a whole, to be working together. And so those are some of the areas. Some of the other factors that we've been looking at is working to form an overdose death review committee that will, unfortunately, it's after the fact, but bringing multiple agencies in together to really look at what has occurred in this person's, you know, time frame, what drugs were being used in what locations, and then it'll help us to analyze, are the policies that are put in place effective, are the programs that are put in place effective, and are they working? And so those are just real quick, just a couple examples, but we can follow up and give you more examples post this meeting if that would work for you, ma'am.
Follow up.
Thank you. That would be great. That's sort of the intent, I think, of asking. And I think with deputy commissioners and commissioners in the audience, these are the kind of things I think this committee would like to see, is the cooperation between the different departments and actually show and demonstrate that it's actually happening and kind of give examples and then show how you're exchanging data and resources and prioritizing what works.
Yep.
So that would have been a great slide.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
To address Deputy Commissioner Mike Duxbury, sir, through the chair,
Senator von Imhoff, another issue that we tried to be very agile and responsive to is when DHSS would acquire some money that it was possible to share over the spectrum of what we're doing between treatment and what we're doing between enforcement. One of the things that we were able to do is to save some pretty significant dangers from occurring with us by utilizing monies they had to help us train in Raman technology, which is a machine that can be handheld so that we don't have to manipulate the powders and stuff that we come across that have fentanyl. So not only do we do that, but we shared the training. Then we went to 19 different communities together to talk to people because we shared his ability to move somebody and my ability to house somebody. So we are taking those and being agile across department lines because we know this is important to the people. It is very important to the folks that if we can make a difference before we have overdoses, because even when we look at it from the perspective of people that gain treatment and come out the other side of this addiction, Mr. Jones is absolutely right. Those are the jewels, whether it's alcohol or drugs, that teach other people how not to be involved in this and that can help them better than any of us can ourselves. And so we recognize what you're talking about, and we'll try to give you some more of those examples.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
The Anchorage interdiction team at the airport. When I first arrived in Anchorage, we had a crisis of how many people that I had ability to choose from the other detachments that had been developed over years and showed an example of how they could work as an investigator because we had low numbers in our detachments. And at that point in time, we only had a few people in an Anchorage office working airport interdictions. By the time we were working together with Andy Jones's team and money that is found and collaborations that we decided to make, we have been able to stand up an airport team that is housed at the airport, that is spending their time at the airport, looking at all those interdictions and ways that people are trying to get around, you know, sneaking it into the state or being subversive about how they bring the product to the state. We've housed a number of people here, and as you can see, this task force is about to grow even a little bit more. It has both North Slope Borough Police Officer with a canine on it because it's important to their area. It has a Sandpoint Police Officer in the unit as well. We understand that when we were some of our choices of how we combated drug trafficking were kind of restricted under SB 91. Not that they were taken away, just restricted, and it made it more difficult. And with few people, we had to maximize how we were doing things. So we've improved interdiction teams because we know it's one of the number one conduits to getting drugs to all of your areas in your in the Alaska.
If I could, I don't see a southeast group on there. Can you?
Sir, if I could go back, Chairman, if I could go back to the previous slide here, and you'll see that. Southeast has Ketchikan CCAD.
Let me rephrase that question. Some of the concerns my constituents have is the ability to route drugs through Anchorage and shipping stuff, shipping them to villages that have no VSPO, Village Public Safety Officer, help, and the detachments of troopers is in the metropolitan areas mainly. And there's a couple guys that cover Prince of Wales, but there seem to be targeting the more remote areas of Southeast to help get their drugs and stuff in. And the concern is going through the shipping systems by air.
Sir, if I might point out, Chairman, that the Anchorage Airport Interdiction Team is not solely concerned with passengers. It is concerned with the mail that's going through the airport, too, in terms of what's getting shipped through the airport. We work closely with the U.S. Postal Service. We work closely with DEA, and we work closely with FBI, who are also members of this team. So we do not solely focus on just the people that are moving through the airport. We focus on baggage and packages and the bulk shipment of money that goes through the airport. And in that light, we are also able to see some of the ancillary effects of drug trafficking, which sometimes gets young people caught up in it, and we can identify trafficking of people as well. So
okay, let's continue.
Okay.
Senator Bishop, we've got to pick up the pace a little bit here.
Where's the U.S. Customs at on that slide? Did I miss it?
U.S. Customs is part of the airport. They are not necessarily part of our airport interdiction team.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Matsu Narcotics Team is just another example. And we know that a lot of the drugs that get to the Matsu come from Anchorage area as well, so there's a lot of collaboration and cooperation. They cover the Copper River, Valdez, and Cordova areas as well as the Matanuska Valley and Susitna Valley. We have four troopers there. In the next iteration, we're hoping to, with maybe some HIDA money, one, bolster that team by providing some local law enforcement folks to the team to work in conjunction with us.
Okay.
South Central Area-Wide Narcotics Team, primary focus is investigating the drug traffickers that are coming down into the peninsula. They move in that direction both by vehicle and by air. And we have just recently incorporated the ability to get the local law enforcement there, but also bolstered that team from when I first arrived and a couple of years ago. And it has had a tremendous impact on the area. Fairbanks Area-Wide Narcotics Team is one that has been very collaborative with the DEA and the FBI and ATF when they have been there. And it is, although you only see these people on the team, we are often found in the same investigations and activities as well as our local federal law enforcement partners. And this is another place that HIDA, High Intensity Drug and Trafficking Area Enforcement funds and resources will bolster our ability. Southeast Alaska Cities Against Drugs. The communities in Southeast have traditionally band together because they're small communities. As you know, a thousand islands, a lot of places for things to come in and a lot of places for drugs and illicit substances to go. The local communities of Ketchikan, Petersburg, Juneau, and those Sitka band together to help each other to work on what can be very specific and very time-intensive and specialized drug investigations in order to help stem the tide of drugs coming into Southeast. It is suspected and most likely true that HIDA was going to be able to bolster that ability to do that as well. As a matter of fact, the federal government is thinking about putting a couple of extra FBI agents in that task force to really put extra effort into the Southeast areas.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, what do we tell people in our areas where the public is well aware of a drug house that's operating with relative impunity? And some of these communities, some of these areas have been operating, these houses have been operating literally for years in a couple of situations. The entire neighborhood is a zombie wasteland, if you will, with overdoses in the communities. Is the public involved, and how can they help when these situations are occurring? Two locations that I can think of specifically, how can they help? And the property crime cost in those communities is disproportionately out of this world compared to other areas.
Senator Machicki, through the chair. I'm actually very glad that you asked me that question, and I'm going to try to answer it in a way that shows some of the enthusiasm I have for what we're about to accomplish here. The bills that have just been proposed have now diminished a really serious situation for us, which was a lack of discretion on how we could operate. And it wasn't that it kept us from doing something, but we had to put our effort and energy into the strategic amounts of drugs that were coming in and hopefully do something like that, because taking somebody off for a couple of grams that just left a drug house that may have been speeding up and down the road, that you can't let your granddaughter run up and down on her bicycle, is important to us. That's quality of life. We were having a hard time enforcing quality of life issues through those drug things. So a couple of things I will address is I think you can tell your constituents that this new crime bill is going to have a major impact on that, and that we are going to have an ability to do quality of life work again. That will also lead us to the strategic levels of what's going on. It's very important that you want to let your family members walk around in a parking lot to go shopping and not have to worry about what drug deal's going down and what somebody might think about's going, where they can get their next little bit of money, right? The next thing is this, is yes, it takes all of us. It takes the public. And the public can be fearful sometimes about what is going on in the drug world to be able to present you with information. We need consistent information. We need information about vehicles, and we need information about times. It is very difficult for me to spend a lot of time. It takes a lot of money to do the surveillance to find out when we can hit a drug house that has enough drugs in it at that time for us to be able to dismantle that organization, go after the money that's been spreading through the community to put other drug houses in place to expand their enterprise. And so what you can tell them is there's help, and it's coming on, and it's on its way.
Okay, we have 20 minutes and 15 slides.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health. So with therapeutic courts, this is just one area where you see a lot of collaboration actually take place. I actually had, like I said, I had the opportunity to sit in here, and this is where judicial, health and social services interact extensively. You know, we fund a lot of the treatment programs that are helping these individuals who are coming through this program. We have those peer recovery services who if you go in and watch this, it's amazing. They're in there helping guide the group or the individual through this process, and obviously corrections and DPS are there too. It is expensive, but it's highly effective. I've been very impressed to see. Now, this just highlights the different drug courts, DUI courts, mental health courts, and the family courts that are across the state. And if you have the opportunity to see this is an amazing collaborative approach where all our resources do come together, and it is doing good for individuals who are struggling with various addictions.
Through the chair, Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections is the largest single provider of substance abuse treatment services and withdrawal services in Alaska. It's not something that certainly we aspire to, but it is out of necessity. We have approximately 80% of our offenders have substance abuse issues, and about 30% of those who have been assessed report having opioid use disorder. So this has had a broad impact on our department in a number of areas. We've seen mental health services increase more than 60% in the last 10 years, and much of that is attributable to the increase in substance use in our communities. We have more acute medical needs than ever before. We see much more complicated medical conditions that have been exacerbated by substance use. We've seen an increase in heroin and prescription drug abuse in particular. As they're coming in our doors, they're reporting that to us. And so our booking process has had to change as a result of that. We've had to retrain our staff in new areas so that they have an increased awareness of where opioid addiction comes into the cycle, and so that we can better identify them at intake. We can identify those who are at greatest risk for overdose, for detoxing and withdrawal within our system, so we can make sure we can keep them safe. Our officers are trained to recognize use, withdrawal, and overdose symptoms. Long-term use over time certainly has impacted our offenders' health. And so as our population ages, we're seeing an increase in the medical issues related to substance use in their backgrounds. And then there's an overall greater increase in demand for DOC to address these issues when, again, we have them as a captive audience. So the department has about 400 slots on any given day that is dedicated to substance abuse treatment in our system. And since about 2011, we've continued to expand our substance abuse services. We have on-site telehealth substance abuse assessments that we do so that we can reach some of our facilities where we don't have individuals or don't have contracts that can come in and provide that service. Now, this last year, we've been able to set up a telehealth system to increase the number of assessments that we provide. We have inpatient substance abuse treatment programs, intensive outpatient programs. We have specific programs dedicated to individuals who have co-occurring disorders, both mental health and substance abuse issues. psychoeducational programs. Our remand facilities, our booking facilities, incredibly high turnover and very transient population, so it's very difficult to put actual treatment programs there. So we have psychoeducation programs. It's a 6-week program where we try to give them as much information in that short amount of time so that they still leave better than when they came in. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the peer-based mentoring. We have alternatives to violence program, a RAP program, wellness action recovery plan, and then True North Recovery, formerly Fiend to Clean, comes in and does peer-based supports for us, speakers bureaus, AANA programs, and additional supports for that warm handoff as those individuals return back to the community. So we have done a lot to reduce our wait lists. In expanding these programs over the last couple of years, we have really reduced our wait list. They still exist, unfortunately. But we do place priority on those with the highest risk, highest needs, as well as those who are close to their end of sentence and who also have a legal requirement to complete substance abuse treatment. And then I think the last slide I have here, we've expanded our supports for substance abuse treatment in some other areas. We have, over the last couple of years, we have really looked at how can we reach those individuals in the halfway houses. And so we have agreements with community providers throughout our state to have dedicated intensive outpatient slots for those individuals in our communities who are housed in our CRCs. And we have about 75 slots for those individuals in all of our communities where we have halfway houses, where for those who require substance abuse treatment, they get the first priority for those specific DOC beds. As I mentioned before, we have the medicated assisted treatment, and I think I have another slide on that later if we have time for that. And then we've really turned our focus to evidence-based treatment curriculums. We've standardized our treatment programs across our facilities. We don't want to just increase the quantity of treatment that we provide, we want to increase the quality, and that really hinges on providing evidence-based programs. And so we've looked at other systems, we've done a lot of research to make sure that the programs that we are providing really do get the best bang for our buck. We recognize that there are some individuals in our systems who don't have ready access to some of the programs that we provide, so we now have a CCT, a closed circuit TV system where we can, this is still kind of a pilot, but where we can provide substance abuse treatment information to individuals who are in segregation and maybe can't participate in some of the mainstream programs that we have. And then we are moving towards a standardized substance abuse assessment program. It's through SAMHSA and is kind of considered the gold standard for providing substance abuse assessment. And this is something that we're partnering with Health and Social Services to provide. And so that is something that we hope to have come online this year as well.
So this is Andy Jones, Department of Health and Social Services. These last couple slides are going to talk about partnerships, outcomes, and results. Just real quick, I want to highlight policy. You guys are probably pretty familiar, but we are in the process of executing a voluntary non-opioid directive. We formed a group between departments and local organizations. Statewide medical standing orders for the naloxone distribution. Controlled substance emergency scheduling has been extremely beneficial. And then strengthening the reporting and education requirements for our pharmacists and healthcare providers has been also a key area. Prevention. This is one of those areas that the success of Project HOPE, and HOPE stands for harm reduction, overdose prevention, and education. The success of having 92 overdose response programs that we don't pay for salary. They are voluntarily providing prevention capabilities, distributing over 18,000 rescue kits in 2 years' time and saving over 250 lives. And that's what people are telling us. We don't mandate that they have to tell us. That's because all of us are here today. And so we have built these community programs, but then Deputy Commissioner Duxbury here, when he was the commander of the drug unit, he had all of the state troopers carrying these kits for their own safety, but also to save lives in the community. And then Laura Brooks and DOC, they provide naloxone so that we no longer have somebody who's incarcerated overdose and die from the potential of an illicit substance. And so it's that force multiplying model that I love to apply, and it's been very successful. The drug medication deactivation disposal bags, same thing. 46,000 of these bags have gone out across our state with the potential to reduce over 2 million prescription pills, patches, or liquid. And so this could not be done if it wasn't for the community and my partners here from state agencies. These are the initial response efforts to some of the things we've done and have been extremely successful. These are great, and I'm just going to say I learned this from Kivalina when I spent a lot of time out there. I remember a lot of times we have those, you know, our pits out there, and if the incinerators are out, you know, I remember seeing pill bottles out there, and this is a great way to throw your medications. It destroys those substances, and it says it's biodegradable. We'll see after 20 years probably. But it also prevents people from being a victim of crime. A lot of the time as Alaskans, you know, we store stuff, and so the last thing you should be doing if you don't have unused or unwanted medications, get rid of it. Some of the other things that we're doing right now is we've partnered together with the Department of Education. We created an opioids epidemic 101 teaching module that was available to all school districts, and I think it was actually available to parents, and it's still out there. So that was a year one project that we embarked on, and we're still partnering with the Department of Education to continue to provide training. First responder training, we're actually looking at compassion fatigue training. This is a real problem in our first responder field, meaning law enforcement, EMS, is day in and day out. They're dealing with individuals who are suffering, but they're also individuals who are, it's hard on them. I've been a first responder almost my whole life, and I didn't even realize I had compassion fatigue at one point in this response if it wasn't for my partner. So we are partnering with public safety and various agencies and communities to bring this training forth. And then we'll get into some of the other topics on community cafe events and the strategic planning.
Senator Machicki, you had a question?
I do. I think it's quite quantifiable that companies like specifically Purdue Pharma are more directly responsible for opioid addiction than all the south of the border drug lords combined. So we made changes to the prescription drug monitoring database. How actively is that monitored, and is it working?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this is Andy Jones, Department of Health. So with the laws that we put in place that now instead of weekly, we're checking it on a daily schedule, and the database, it's been very successful. We've gotten, I don't know the number off topic, but I can give you the talking points post this meeting about the percentage of prescribers in there. It's been very helpful for us when it comes.
We're going to run out of time.
Okay, I'll follow up with that, sir.
I'll follow up with an answer to the committee, and we'll disperse that.
Yes, sir. This is Andy Jones, Health, continuing on. So treatment real quick, we already kind of talked about this, but we have worked to increase the treatment bed capability in our state, nearly 300 residential treatment beds, 300 medication-assisted treatment prescribers. Remember, half of them are the ones who are actually prescribing, but we're working to expand that. One of the things that we've done is Project Echo. We've partnered with ANTHC and Providence, and this Project Echo platform allows providers to get together on a secure platform and be able to discuss situations and issues in relation to substance use disorder and help work with each other so that they can work through these challenging processes, and so that's been a great partnership. The other piece is the Open Beds platform. Currently, we have the websites right there, a bed availability tool, but we want to build upon and make a more comprehensive tool that's available for our providers and the public that will help them, guide them through the continuum of care.
So you have 7 slides in 7 minutes.
We can do that, sir.
This is the high-intensity drug trafficking area conversation that we wanted to have, and just an overview of it is that we expect to be improving our program that is doing the interdiction. Task force expansions, improving our technology and our ability to use technology in all kinds of investigations, and develop stronger private partnerships, private sector partnerships, which have been extremely helpful to us. We take some of the bags to like the oil and gas industry and talk to the folks at the oil and gas industry. If you have a lost time accident, please give one of these out to one of your guys. So we're looking at every aspect we can to engage the public and improve our ability to do the enforcement part of it as a component to understanding that we're a piece of the pie.
Laura Brooks for the Department of Corrections through the chair. We have changed our detox and withdrawal management protocols in the last 3 years. We reached out to DHSS and looked at how other areas of our state provide that service. We've changed our intake screening. We now have special housing and observation platforms so that we can make sure that individuals who are at high risk for significant withdrawal are carefully monitored. We have special housing placements for them, medical protocols to keep them safe. And then we are in the process of developing detox beds for women at Highland. Right now we don't have any detox beds specific to women, so they're housed in our men's infirmary. So that's a project that we have in the works. And then in terms of the medicated assistant treatment, I spoke about that a little bit already. But that is really right now, the primary area of that is our Vivitrol program. It's an injection that blocks the effects of opioids for about 28 days. And we have, we evaluate those individuals to make sure that it's safe for them to take this medication. And then they get that injection within about 3 days of release. So far, we've administered that to about 115 individuals in the last year. The early results, we actually have partnered with Health and Social Services to do a research project to really identify the benefits of that. Right now, we're receiving those injections for no cost from the pharmaceutical company, but we know at some point that generosity is going to end. And so we want to make sure that when that time comes, we can say that we are going to continue this because it's effective, or you know, maybe there will be some other results. So we know that there's research out there that shows that using Vivitrol upon release reduces the mortality rate immediately upon release, but we don't yet know how does that work in the long run for criminal recidivism and clinical recidivism, or
might
clinical
want to go to
relapse.
The next slide.
This is Andy Jones, Department of Health. This just highlights our strategic direction. We actually created a statewide opioid action plan. It's on the webpage in your document online. It'll link you to it. I just want to highlight that all these agencies right here, community partners, we built this from the ground up. We went in with really, you know, not dictating anything and asking the community what was the problem. We gathered this data and we formed over 100-person advisory groups, our advisory team that developed a plan for us. So it's an Alaska-based plan built by the community for the community. So here's the piece when we talked about results. Overdose deaths. Has the country spiking in overdose deaths? And please remember these are just preliminary right now because we're waiting on toxicology and death certificates. But I want to share, you know, losing any one Alaskan is not acceptable to me. But if you look at the trends from 2017 to 2018, we're going down in every category of drug overdose deaths. And so some of the ones I want to highlight is opioid overdoses. As a whole, we are down 42%. Fentanyl deaths, which are skyrocketing in the country, we're going down. We're 75% decrease at this point. Something's working. It may be Narcan, it's our partnerships, it's the direction that we're moving towards. So I just wanted to highlight this piece here. We still have a lot of work forward to go with. These are prelim results, but it is exciting news to see this trend. And the last slide, next steps. We need to transition, step one, transition from the incident command system that's very time intensive to something that's more long term. I'm working with multiple agencies to look at what this long-term recovery would be. Some states have an Office of Drug Control Policy or a drug policy coordinator, somebody who can look at all the state systems and say, what are the most effective approaches we need to take as we move forward in addressing this, especially when we're on a slim diet budget coming forth. Next step would be implementation of the statewide opioid action plan, continuing to get federal funding and building that capacity in enforcement, prevention, treatment, and recovery services. We have to do this together, and we have to build a continuum of care that is effective, it's easy for our public, and it's beneficial to everybody. Step three is implementation of the high-intensity drug trafficking area, regional task forces, new grant. This is really important for us. And then step four is focusing on the economic impact of programmatic investments. The UAA, Alaska Justice Information Center, produced the first Alaska in results first, thank you, a couple years ago. Programs are changing, and so free to cost, they're willing to look at our data and update this. This shows the return on investment, what are the best programs compared to the nation and to here. And so this is one thing that we want to partner with UA on and move forward with. And with that, we made it through all 57 slides, and
we could back up to
questions.
Slide 55, please.
Yes, sir.
It kind of surprises me here. You're looking at the age group 55 to 64, and then 45 to 64, 55% of the people.
To the chair, Andy Jones, Department of Health. This is a concern of mine. As the trend in the national arena is more of the 25 to 34 year age that's really affected. And for us in Alaska, I don't know if it's because our population's aging more that we're seeing this problem, but this is one of the surprise shocks that we've noticed this year in an uptick. And so we've been doing a lot of education and focus on our older population on the dangers of, you know, prescription medications and the potential of sharing, which we found out does occur.
Did we have any final questions from committee members? Senator Machicki and Senator Hoffman.
Well, I think you caught it. Prescription opioids is still the vast majority of the opioid fatalities, and if you drop down, the prescription opioids have dropped significantly. Quick question, Mr. Chairman, can we get this in a graph form, same categories but from 13 to 18, please?
Okay. And then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the question that I asked earlier on is by region and by year and by the four steps. What are the plans, and I think you alluded to it, Mr. Chairman, what are the plans from a cost perspective on the next steps by year, by region, and by each of the steps? Do we have cost estimates for implementation of next steps, which is probably the most critical to this committee as we are the Finance Committee?
If you could help us with that data, we'll sooner than later, of course, we'll be starting in earnest the budget process on the 14th, or actually the 13th, we'll start laying it out, but it'll take us a few days to digest it. But so you've got a couple weeks, I suppose, but Senator Von Imhoff, heading up that subcommittee, will be very interested in all the help she can get data-wise to make the best decisions, recommendations to the committee. That will conclude the meeting today. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for being on time and working with us on the calendar. We're about a minute late, which is no big thing. We are adjourned.